Check the condition of your heart, of your mind, of your body. Come back to alignment, to harmony with them. And the title of this talk is Kindness, Compassion, the World. I'd like to begin with a quote. And the day came when the risk it took to stay tight inside the bud. You understand bud? Like the flower before,
okay.
Small. And the day came when the risk it took to stay tight inside the bud was more painful than the risk it took to blossom. This is a quote by a writer, a woman named Anais Nin. Maybe some of you heard the name, yeah? And the day came when the risk it took to stay tight inside the bud was more painful than the risk it took to blossom. Coming towards the end of a retreat, all of you faced, probably many times, this kind of question that might not even be verbal, but just as an inner movement of, it's too risky, the unknown over there. Let me just stay in my comfort zone, go through the motions that I know how to do, and stay in this fake safety. There is a big confusion between these two terms of, let's say, comfort and comfortable, even though the root in English is probably the same. It's the same root, right? In Hebrew, it's not quite the same. Maybe in German, it's also different. I'll tell you the difference. Comfort is all these things that we are trying to get to in our lives in order to be comfortable. So comfort and comfortable are not the same thing. Like, we might think we need a certain kind of temperature in the room for us as a comfort zone, for us to be comfortable. But actually, when time goes by, and let's say we are on a retreat and we enlarge the vessel, we learn to be with different kinds of conditions when it's not so much difficult anymore to be, let's say, with the temperature that before we thought it's just impossible for us. For you, it might be hot. For me, coming from a hot climate, might be cold. And something that is actually deeper in the being is managed to be in that way and be comfortable. Be comfortable. So oftentimes, as human beings, we are trading comfort for comfortable. We actually condition our state of heart and mind of being comfortable with this worldly, ever-changing condition of comfort. And we are sure that if we will not get these kind of conditions, we will be miserable. Actually, practice points out to the radical opportunity for us as human beings to be comfortable with conditions, in spite of conditions. Sometimes the conditions can be really difficult. There is a true story, apropos the Dalai Lama, who is blessing us with his beautiful shining face here all this week in this photo, that he met with an old monk, Tibetan monk, that was kept in captivity by the Chinese for many, many years and was tortured like many others, yeah, Tibetan lamas. And when he met with him and he fell down to his feet and he was really revering this old man that went through so much pain. And he asked him, "Dear Lama, in all those many years, I think it was 20 years that he was in prison, tortured, in all those many years, were there times that you felt fear?" And this old man said something really incredible. He said to him, "There were a few times that the Chinese hit me so hard that I was afraid I will lose my compassion to them." And we hear that and we say, wow, yeah, it's such a stretch of the heart. And how can a human being even have this state of heart and mind? But this is possible with practice. One of my teachers, his name was Ramesh Balsekar in Bombay, he used to define awakening, enlightenment, saying, it's very simple. It's about being comfortable with oneself, comfortable with others. That's it. This is awakening. This is enlightenment. It takes us a little bit to the other direction. Yeah, the small little things in life that irritate us so much and we tend to push and pull and react. And then the human possibility that we have, all of us, we all have Buddha nature. Yeah, we talked about it the first day, remember? The golden Buddha. So it means we have the potential of being comfortable in spite of conditions. In spite of conditions. It doesn't mean the conditions are going to be pleasant, but pleasant or unpleasant, it does not have to steal our heart. It does not have to put us into jail. We don't have to condition our happiness and well-being because the tea was not hot enough, or somebody said a nasty word to me, or somebody was really rude on the road, or I had a huge fight with my son, daughter, boyfriend, husband, wife, mother, father, whatever. These are unpleasant things that happen in the course of life. Of course, death of dear and beloved people in our lives. Yeah, it's hard. And of course, when we go through emotional upheaval, it's hard. It's unpleasant, it's difficult. And yet, there is a part in us that is able to stay open and compassionate with all these waves, proper ocean, waves of life. So I would like to talk about these opportunities we have as human beings and mention again the teaching of the qualities of the heart. So I was presenting the first quality of, it's called metta in Pali, or Maitrei in Sanskrit. It's friendship, love, kindness, goodness. Yeah, and we've been cultivating this all week. Beautiful, beautiful quality. The second one in line, which is one of the divine abodes, the four divine palaces, because they make us divine when they are cultivated in the heart. The second one is compassion. And I said a little bit about compassion the other day, and I might repeat it. Compassion, it's this, one may say, the tremble of the heart when it meets suffering, ours or another. Something in the heart gets touched, and the heart really trembles You understand tremble? Like a little bird that is shaken a little bit. Thank you. That's compassion. It comes in English, it comes from the Latin con, passion, meaning to be able to be with pain, to be able to be with pain of others or ourselves. Yeah. So there's a difference between pity and compassion. When we pity someone, we look from up and there is fear and there is rejection, right? Like a beggar comes in the street and we're like, just to get rid of our uncomfortable feeling from that side, we just, okay, take something and just leave us alone so we can, yeah, be safe. It comes out of the wish, the deep wish for safety, yeah, as well. Not to judge ourselves for that, but just see the difference. What does it mean to be compassionate? To be able to meet the pain, eye level. Eye level. It's not easy, it's a practice. A dear friend, teacher, colleague of mine, Charles Genoux, I think he's going to be here in 2 weeks' time, actually, teaching for the first time here in Pauenhof. He's a Swiss teacher, very, very wise and full of heart. And he spent many years in India. And in India, most of you have been, yeah, there's so many beggars. So many beggars. And you go to India and you're like, wow, what can I cannot possibly give to all these beggars? What can I do? And some people really get overwhelmed with this amount of everything is outside. Yeah. Just like pain, just like sickness, just like death. So begging, and they come and they can be quite rude, you know, the children start and it's like, oh, but you cannot, what can you do? And some people manage to go through the whole trip in India just not giving anything out of shutting down. Again, no judgment, just seeing this pain of the heart, of fear. And he said something very beautiful, I find. He said, you cannot give to all the beggars you meet, but you can meet all the beggars you meet. Meeting. What does it mean to meet? Compassion. To be in that meeting place. And this sentence came very handy to me when I was living in Bombay. I was going to see my teacher every day. Teacher of non-duality, Advaita Vedanta, that was some years ago. Bombay is an amazing place, full of beggars. And there was one child in particular, there's many, many street children there. And he was, I think, also not very sharp in his mind and limping. And he would come with his smile to all the tourists. And mostly nobody really gave him anything, but he would try again and again. And at one point, I said, wow, I really want to meet. I really want to see how is it like, not just to give him 5 rupees and, okay, go away. But I start to, you know, to reach out and, yeah, or hold his hand or pet his head. And something in the relationship got completely changed. It was no longer... And I spent some time there. It was no longer, I'm the white person coming with the money and he's the unprivileged, underprivileged boy. Yeah, this level, this layer was, sorry, was also there. But it was more about meeting. It was so much joy of the heart, just meeting. Yeah. And I think we all know that once we are crossing our fears from the other, from the different, what might he want from me? And immediately we go like this. So the compassion is the practice of the heart of not closing down. Not closing down. What closes us down is fear. Fear closes us down. Again, no judgment. Just noticing. Seeing, fear is making me now petrified sometimes even. And the heart goes with many layers. And we are the first to suffer. Not this boy in the street. When we have this inner weather of, yeah, closeness and coldness. Yeah, we are suffering. So actually, this is one of the tricks. If we really want to be happy, and that's one of the Dalai Lama's famous quotes, practice giving, practice compassion, because you will be the first to enjoy it. Obviously, we know that. So with compassion, one of the teachers I know called it fierce love. So strong love. Yeah, that would be like a warrior. Fierce love, like a spiritual warrior. Sometimes, you know, you see it in yoga, you see it in meditation. If you'll move, you look for the comfort and you move with every little thing you feel, you would never be able to cultivate this container. And of course, we don't want the other side of pushing ourselves too hard, but hey, middle way here. Yeah. So fierce love, sometimes it really takes everything we got to look at pain like that and not be overwhelmed by it, because the first fear is this. How can I remember Rumi's poem? How can I do that? I have so much pain. How can I even meet somebody else's pain? I would be overwhelmed. I'll drown with them. And that's why the other qualities are coming to our help. So together with the friendship and with the compassion, we have also the quality of joy. And these qualities, and I'll tell you the fourth one in a minute, these qualities are both fruits of the practice and also the practice itself. It's really cool. Practicing joy. And without me telling you too much about it, we've been practicing it all week. Yeah. Just going outside in this beauty. And I saw some of you this morning walking. It was so beautiful. And there was this visitor. I don't know who he was, but he was like going around like he was in paradise or something. Everybody was walking so sweetly on the grass, and some were stopping next to these amazing roses, and everything was like, wow, this picture was so beautiful. Yeah. So it evokes the sense of joy in us. And joy has two sides to it. One would be appreciative joy. Very simple. We appreciate where we are, the beautiful people here, the food, the tasty food, the fact that we have this amazing place to ourselves to practice, yeah, for the whole week. You know how rare this is? Really, I mean, and we are in this really, really small group of people, and everybody gets to get this attention. You know how rare this is? Especially in this kind of realms, yeah, of courses. And Michael so kindly gave us this whole vicinity. We can use this hall and the other hall and the whole place. And wow, we are so lucky. You know, so it brings the sense of joy, appreciative joy. And this is, by the way, a good medicine when we feel dry or gray or everything sort of doesn't matter anymore and we don't find the juice of life. We can deliberately practice finding the joy, because this is one of the qualities that is very important to cultivate for the liberation. It's like, I didn't know Buddhism can be about joy. It is. It's really, really important. The second half of the joy would be sympathetic joy. Joy we feel for the others. Easy. So it's easy to feel it with the children, with our children if we have it. Easy if you don't have children to feel it with our students. Yeah. Because they're also part of us in a way. Yeah. It's harder to feel it with people we don't like. When something is good is happening to someone we don't like so much, it's like, I don't feel the joy. Something in us feels, oh, it's on my account. But actually, again, quoting the Dalai Lama, if we are practicing, celebrating with somebody else's joy, our joys will be so great, because there are so many of them. We are only one. So we have a few joys here and there, but if we learn to really rejoice in somebody else's happiness, we'll have so much happiness. Very practical, yeah? That's a practice. So joy. And the fourth one of these qualities will be the state of mind and the heart of equanimity. Equanimity. Meaning evenness or deep stability, you might also say. Deep emotional stability. And see that it's very different from indifference. I don't care. Exactly. Exactly. So just like with compassion and pity, I don't care. I don't care about anybody. I don't, it's like just me. But actually equanimity is one of the most important qualities that we can develop. It appears in many, many lists of the Buddha, not just in this list of four qualities of the heart. And it's one of the qualities that we are cultivating and developing as well on the way to fully being a fully awakened one, awakening of the heart and mind, equanimity. So we were talking about the vessel. This is it. To be able to have this, like this posture in yoga, like a big, great mountain that we are just sitting there, and sometimes rain comes, sometimes sun, sometimes this, sometimes that. Animals come, trees, something is being burned. The mountain is there, hopefully, most of the time. Yeah? So these kind of qualities. And we are developing these qualities, and they are being developed in us even if we do not know it. It's a little bit, again, like the domino effect. Sometimes, you know, we just simply sit with our breath, but there's some kind of friendship and kindness with that. And then the kindness is being developed in us, and some compassion, and then more and more and more. And every time that there is a moment of compassion, it gives rise to other moments of compassion. It's a beautiful thing to remember. Every time there's a moment of mindfulness, it paves the way to other moments of mindfulness, just like in yoga practice. Yeah? If we forget, it forgets us twice. Yeah. It's a saying in Hebrew, I'm not sure it's well translated. It's like an old, old saying. So it's so much about putting our hearts into what we want to cultivate and let it shine in us. Yeah. So, and these qualities, you know, they seem to be very personal. It's me and my heart and my mind and my practice and my body and my this and my that, but actually it's a huge service to the world. And people have been asking again and again, what about responsibility? So maybe this action of cultivating the mind and heart is already such a huge step towards peace, towards well-being, not just of ourselves, but also of others. And we all know how it is when somebody comes full of negativity and blame and talks to us, and something in our energy field already got a bit contracted and it's hard to bear sometimes. And when we're cultivating these qualities, we can meet this in a different way. And also, we recognize when somebody comes with these qualities and they are developed in her or him, we immediately, there's a resonance. You know this term, mirror neurons? Yeah, the scientific terms. Something in us gets ignited in the same way. So it's actually not just about us. Everything we're doing here, it won't be worth anything, really, if it would be just about us. It's not interesting so much. But hey, it really has roots way far into the world. So there is a beautiful story about starfish. You know this animal, sea animal, starfish? It looks like a star. It's not really a fish, that's the name in English, but it lives in the beach. Sister? Sister. Sister. Sister, yeah. Okay, sister also. And it's really very gentle kind of animal. It hardly moves. It can move. It has these little tiny, tiny little like eyelashes on its legs. And it's like very slowly it moves. And it needs, of course, water. And sometimes when the tide is really low, it can be left on the sand to die, actually. When the tide is really, really low, so you can see, and it needs the water and the moisture in order to survive. So the story goes like this. There was a man walking on the beach and seeing many, many starfish like that, that the sea abandoned. The sea, the water went back very far, and they were dying on the sand. It was hot, hot sun. Many, many of them. And then he saw this young child bending down and throwing them one by one back to the sea. Now, can you imagine this picture? It's a huge beach covered with these starfishes. And this child, you know, small young child, bending down, throwing them back into the sea. So this adult comes up to the child and say, "What are you doing? Do you think your action matters at all? Look at all these thousands, tens of thousands of starfish. Do you think what you're doing really matters?" And the child, as an answer, bends down, picks up another starfish, throws it into the water and says, "For him, it matters." Everything we do matters. Every little action we do matters. And as Mother Teresa once said, you don't have to be doing great things. It's good enough to do small things with great love. So we are cultivating love here, friendship, kindness. And in our lives, how can we do this even smallest of things with this attitude? That's an ongoing practice, to face the view that what we are doing doesn't really matter. How can we possibly influence anything that is going on in the level of politics, in the level of global warming? Yeah, we might think, this is way too big and I'm so small. But this is actually a wrong view. The only way, really, change happened all through history were with small groups of people that were awakened. Awake enough to see, I can make a difference, I can make change. And we start very small with our bodies, with our mind, with our hearts, and it can go so deep, so far. You know this butterfly effect? So never underestimate your actions, your practice, the fruit of your practice. And it's so much about the view. Many years ago, I was involved in Israel in creating this organization. We called it Middle Way, of course. And we took after Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi. And it was in the days of the Second Intifada, around 2002 it was. And it was, Israel was really suffering a lot. The people were suffering a lot. There were suicide attacks and bombs going off in cafes and restaurants. And also on the Palestinian side, people suffered a lot because of the revenge of the army. And it was a mess. It was really, really difficult situation. And people were in a lot of fear from each other, the Palestinians, the Israelis. It was, and after one retreat we did, we felt, wow, at the end of the retreat, the fruits of the retreat that have been cultivated in our hearts, the love, the compassion, the gentleness, it was such a strong difference from the reality out there. And some of us felt we really want to bring the fruits of the practice into the daily life in Israel-Palestine. And we created this organization, and we decided to simply do a walking meditation through Israel-Palestine. Just walk one file, one single file. We haven't been practicing that in the retreat. When a group of people, it's like in monasteries until today, a group of people is walking, monks, nuns, practitioners, one after the other, very mindfully, very gently on the earth. Not a political act, if actually everything is a political act, but we didn't carry any signs, we didn't identify ourselves with any political party. And we walked, it was the first walk was for 1 week from Jaffa to Jerusalem. And everybody we met on the way that asked us questions, we had this leaflet and we were just wearing white sashes, like that's it. That was the only recognition sign we had. And it was like a moving retreat. We were Israelis, Palestinians, and internationals that came. It was wonderful to support. And after a year, we did the same in the Galilee. And at one point, it was really, really beautiful. We had this silent walk part of the day, and then we would sit together with small circles and share our experience and talk. And people would come and ask questions, and we were just, you know, together in that way. And at one point, I was leading the walk. We had 100 people. And the plan was to go through an Arab village. The name is Umm al-Fahm. And in Israel, it's well known, or back then it has really bad reputation. And the media refer to it as a wasp's nest. Yeah, so dangerous for Israelis, so dangerous. And I remember, before that walk, I felt a bit anxious because, okay, I go there myself, for me, no problem, but I deal with whatever, but 100 people, like I felt the responsibility. And I remember even my parents told me, you're taking too much responsibility on you. There's 100 people, you know? And I was just, okay, let's see. I trust Dharma. I trust our good intention. Let's do it anyway. So we were walking there. I was leading this walk, and with me, we're walking up in the front, two people, two men in their 40s and 50s. One of them was Israeli, the other was Palestinian. And both of them lost their children in this war. And they were walking together. And we weren't sure, you know, would we be recognized? I mean, when you live in Israel, Palestinians know who is Israeli and Israelis know who is Palestinian. From international, maybe it's not so clear. Language is different, look is different. So we knew we would be recognized as Israelis, and we were walking there through the streets of Umm al-Fahm, through the main street, single file of 100 people. Very quietly, just walking meditation, and handing these leaflets out with three languages, English, Hebrew, Arabic, explaining what we do in the tradition of non-violent actions, like Mahatma Gandhi, like Martin Luther King, like the monks and nuns in the Vipassana tradition, in the Buddhist tradition, that in times of war, they came out of the monasteries and they just walked the earth. And people start coming out of their houses and gave us food and gave us drinks and joined us. And it was beautiful. In and of itself, it was such a beautiful experience to be so welcomed. I remember I felt so, wow, you know, this difference between what I imagined before because of the media. Wasp's nest, this village, you know, you don't go there if you're Israeli. Be careful, they're going to kill you, they're going to kidnap you, they're going to, you know, this, that, the Muslims, they're all going to kill you, you know, all that. And then the actuality of what happened there was just, wow, you know, shocking, shocking, really. And the hospitality and the friendship and many, many good things happened from that walk and onwards. Many beautiful initiatives and so forth. So, kindness and compassion. Never underestimate the power of these qualities. They're much stronger, much more powerful than the force of fear. And when we agree to see the pain, or when we agree to see what we usually tend not to want to see because we're too afraid we'll be run over, it's just too much. But when we more and more cultivate these qualities of steadiness, open-hearted, we actually realize that not that it doesn't make us more vulnerable, it makes us actually flexible. The ego, when we are trapped into our egos, we're very fragile there. Every word can really be so painful and shake us. But when the qualities of the heart are cultivated, we walk with fear. It's not that fear is gone. Fear doesn't have to go anywhere. It's there as a friend. We walk with it anyway, but we do. We do it. We walk with it. It doesn't stop us. And then it can change into something else. The remedy for fear is love. It's two opposite movement, inner movement inside. It's in the text of the Buddha. It's so such a beautiful story. He came to a group of monks and nuns who were practicing in the forest, and they told him they are really, really afraid because the forest is full of ghosts. And all the time, you understand ghosts? All the time they have this fear. And they asked him, please give us another forest to practice in. And he said, no, I will give you a medicine. I will give you, he actually said, weapon to work with the fear. And he taught them the medicine of love. This practice we were practicing in this retreat, that's the ancient practice. And if you can see it inwardly, when we're afraid of something, fear is like, it has this tendency to, yeah, we collapse into something really small because we want to protect. But just like with pain, this is the natural response, but it's not very healthy. We want to do something else there. How can we open up, actually? So love is one of the answers here. Friendship, it's like the opposite movement inwardly. Yeah, understand? And, you know, when we see the state of the world as it is right now, we start to care. We start to care in an organic way for things that until now we really didn't care about. They didn't touch us. They felt over there, not my interest, not my family. I don't care about them. I don't remember who was this German writer. Yeah, maybe some of you would know. He had this one phrase. Yeah, don't know. He said, we invited workers. We invited workers, but then came people. We invited workers, but then people came. Yeah, it's like, how do we deal with that? And one of the ways in which we deal with that is the changing point of view practice. Changing point of view. To put ourselves in the shoes of another. And there's this American Indian native saying, like it's a prayer. Dear Creator, let me not criticize another until I walked a mile in their moccasins. Dear Creator, the American Indians pray to their gods, let me not criticize another until I walked a mile in their moccasins. So to change our point of view, to understand better, yeah, and by that we are enlarging our capacity to live fully. Because when we close ourselves down from fear of further pain, then we close ourselves down for the joy and the love as well. It goes together. We can't just imagine a stick which has two sides to it. And I want the nice side, but I don't want the other side. And then I cut it. But I'm left in two sides, again, with two sides. Not possible to get rid of one. They go together. It's a whole. So I'd like to invite us to reflect in our lives. What would be the starfish? Small little starfish it can be. I was talking to you yesterday about the fireflies. Yeah? How do you call it again? Yeah. Okay. This one, this animal, it's almost extinct, almost gone from everywhere. It needs a special kind of habitat, and here, you know, little by little, all these animals or trees that have not much voice to speak up, but they are disappearing. They disappear one after another. There used to be many, many more fireflies all over the world, and now it's like so rare, so scarce. Why is that? And when we open our eyes, we start to see the connection. Because if you imagine this firefly as a part of our heart, and then it starts to be less and less important in a way, and more other things take over, yeah? Just to see it, what are these other things that take over? Why all these species are being extinct outwardly and inwardly? They need very gentle condition to survive, very specific condition to survive, just like our compassion, just like our love, just like our very gentle tendencies inside. And we are, when we are overwhelmed with greed, hatred, and delusion, there's no room for these butterflies. There's no room for these fireflies, really. So part of us is being frozen and can turn into a desert. And there's a process that is well known in the world right now, a process of, it's called desertification. Really fertile parts of the world are getting more and more unfertile, like deserts. Yeah. And the state of the world and our inner state are very tightly connected. And I cannot even say connected, it's one thing. It's really one thing. And what it's going to take from us, what does it ask us? What would be the right action in this state? When we look at our hearts and we say, out of greed, hatred, and delusion, I put myself in this kind of jail. Everything is flat and life loses its juice and meaning and beauty. It's still reversible. This is practice. There's always hope. Always, as long as we live. There's a beautiful saying by one of the famous rabbis in like 200 years ago. If you believe that you can mess things up, please believe that you can correct them. Always hope. Always, as long as, he said, the candle is lightning, is lit. As long as the candle is lit, there is still a chance to correct. This is beautiful. Please do not lose hope. There's always hope. But it calls for the right response. It calls for the courage of the heart. You know this word heart, cœur in French, courage. There's a connection. The heart has this capacity to be courageous. And it asks again for everything that we have. What do we care for? What is important to us in our lives? what happens to our soul when the fireflies will be extinct? What happened to our grandchildren when they would never ever see a firefly in their lives? Yes, maybe they can go on living, but what kind of life would it be? What would we like to give them? Yeah. So it asks the right response, and the right response inwardly would be to take care when we see this movement of greed, hatred, and delusion in us. Greed tells us the story that if we do not get the object it tells us we need to get, we'll be miserable. This is a myth. It's not true. This is a lie. Actually, oftentimes it's the other way around. When we are free from greed, we are much happier, and you all know it. You all know it well. But still, it's like junk food. We go into it. It takes a lot of stamina. Understand this word? Energy. And like a spiritual warrior. Yeah, we have to be. There's strong forces on humankind that are acting not in our favor and also in our planet. It's so easy to make people fear, make people afraid of the other. Oh, he's the other, and then something in my heart gets closed. But actually, there's so much to learn from somebody that is different. We don't have to be equal. There's nothing equal about us. Each is very unique. Each has his gift and beauty. So let me check how we're doing with time. There is a beautiful poem by, it's here, by an American Palestinian woman poet. Her name is Naomi Shihab Nye, and she writes about kindness. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolves in a moment, like salt in a weakened broth, like soup. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go, so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop, the passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you. He too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread, catches the thread of all sorrows, and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, it is I you have been looking for, and then goes with you everywhere like a shadow or a friend. So let's sit with this words together a few more moments. Embracing life with all its forms, cultivating the courageous heart that can open up in compassion, in kindness, in friendship, and cultivating the courage to act in the right response.